Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet, and I have a very special guest today. The Emmy Award-winning writer and producer of many television, film, and video programs. His name is Scott Katamas, and he's joining us today. We're actually going to be talking about how we can have more compassionate communication skills and stop judging, blaming, criticizing, and shaming each other, and probably ourselves. But just, you know, a little bit about Scott. You might have actually watched some of his programming on television, especially cable programs. The subject matter oftentimes was about UFOs. So if you've ever watched NBC's The Other Side, Strange Universe, Looking Beyond, or The Paranormal, then you are watching some of Scott Katamas' work. We're not going to be talking about that too much today, but if we're lucky, he might share a couple of stories with us, maybe something about Area 51. But something else you might want to know about Scott is that he wrote and produced a much-acclaimed film called Men in Love that was released in 1990. And they actually wrote it up in the New York Times, so apparently well-received. Scott, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me well?
I can hear you great. I understand that you're calling us from Kentucky today.
Yeah, I'm part of them. I've been traveling throughout the Midwest teaching for the last 2 weeks. I was in Chicago for a couple of days and Indiana, and this weekend I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. Sharing these tools with really a wonderful group of people here, actually.
Now, the tools that you're referring to there are those of compassionate communication, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, I got a quick question for you. Compassionate communication, nonviolent communication, I've heard those used interchangeably. I'm here on your website right now, which is Scott Katamas. That's Scott, C-A-T-A-M-A-S. And Scott's Katamas.com, and you got a giraffe in one hand, and I think that's a jackal in the other one. The puppet.
Right.
The puppet, yeah. And I know those do come out of Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication, or as a lot of people say, NBC for short. Is there a connection between that and compassionate communication?
They're pretty much really one and the same. I was first hired, the way I got turned on to all of this, was I was hired by the Center for Nonviolent Communication to produce a series of videotapes about Marshall Rosenberg. And so it was a great gig because it gave me a chance to travel around the Western Hemisphere with Marshall, watching him at work in a very wide variety of settings. I saw him working in prisons. I saw him working with educators. I saw him working with families and couples. And what struck me was that regardless of the culture, people were really getting amazing results. And actually, frankly, mostly I was impressed seeing, oh, my God, this even works for prison inmates who are not, you know, New Age workshop junkies, but, you know, guys who have an average of an eighth grade education. And even they were having life-changing experiences. So that really made a big impression on me. And at the time, actually, Marshall explained that when he first started this over 30 years ago, he really wanted to honor the legacy of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. And the idea of nonviolence was very in his consciousness. And he never thought this was going to become a worldwide movement. And now there are practice groups in over 100 countries. It's truly a global phenomenon. And he himself actually said that if he had to do all over again, he would have renamed it Compassionate Communication. So we're all, or many of us, are kind of transitioning. You know, I'll still refer to it as NBC, but I much prefer calling it compassionate communication. And also,
okay,
each of us takes it into our own direction. You know, I've always been very rebellious. I've always been very independent. So, you know, I take a lot of Marshall's wonderful work, but I have my own my own take on certain things, and I weave in some of my observations of life. And there's sometimes that, you know, I'm a little bit non-traditional in my approach to how I present this. So
yes, and I've actually been to Marshall's website, and you cannot use the words nonviolent communication unless you are certified through them, I think. They've trademarked that.
That's right. They've trademarked that. And
so have you trademarked compassionate communication?
No, the Center for Nonviolent Communication has... Oh, no. Compassionate communication is being used by dozens of us, you know. It's being used by a lot. And usually the way that they record, they're very mellow about it. Well, Marshall and also Robert Gonzalez, who's now the president of the board of directors and a good friend of mine, is the one I just produced a three-disc DVD series for. As Marshall and Robert say, the best bet is just to say, this is my teaching, in this case, Scott Thomas's teaching, based on my understanding of nonviolent communication and based on my understanding of compassionate communication, which is really true.
Right.
That's my understanding of it. It's how I like to deal with this and present it to people.
Well, so have you completely given up on writing and producing films?
Oh, never say never. But I'm so loving sharing these tools, and I'm actually now in the midst of producing my own videos. I'm writing a book and a companion DVD series called Practical Guide to Joyful Relationships.
Say that again, because it's a little hard for me to hear. A practical guide to what?
A practical guide to joyful relationships.
Ah, joyful relationships. Well, that
absolutely
sounds wonderful.
You know, we all want more joy in our relationships. And, you know, based on my observation of you, Veronica, you strike me as somebody who definitely has joyful relationships. I mean, I haven't had much experience of you, but my experience of you has been that you're passionate, you're present, and those to me are like the keys. If we're really fully present with what is, and we're passionate about those things in our life that we're teaching or sharing or learning or exploring, then usually that makes for a joyful life. And these tools...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I've been divorced now for 4 years, but my ex-husband and I still problem solve. We're each other's best friends, basically. So we spend quite a bit of time together, and we also spend quite a bit of time apart. But when we touch bases, we are constantly using the... Now, we didn't take tools from the NVC, but it's similar stuff that we got out of things like men overcoming violence out of the Bay Area up in San Francisco. And we had worked through their program and their workbook, and it's just amazing when you have tools, communication tools, very specific tools that are geared towards how to solve problems, you know, something that you can apply in real life, how far that will carry you. So, I would honestly say that I have a tremendous amount of joy, and it's possible under any circumstances. You can be incompatible with somebody. You can be divorced. It really doesn't matter as long as you're willing to do the work. And I think, I don't know if you agree, but I think that's the defining thing. How much joy do you want tends to be answered by how much work are you willing to do.
Well, that's certainly a big piece of it, of course. And it's important to take responsibility and to keep learning, to not keep repeating patterns that don't work, but rather to learn what works. And that's the key to success in anything, is to keep learning, keep growing.
I would imagine is why people take your workshops, right?
Absolutely. And like I always say to people, I'm going to give you the tools, but whether or not you have success is whether or not you... Last year, I've probably worked with close to 100 couples. And, you know, of course, there's an amazing range of people's experiences. Of course, I'm delighted with the dozens and dozens of couples that use these tools and send me emails or do video testimonials or call me and say, my God, thank you so much. You know, our relationship has really changed. It's so much better. We're so much happier. You know, there's stories people have worked with they were getting divorced. It was it. He was sleeping on the couch, and, you know, they were meeting with litigation attorneys. And by working with them and using these tools, they've applied the tools, and now they're getting along well. And there's also people that come to the workshop or that I've worked with who haven't applied the tools and can't understand why the relationship hasn't changed, why they're still fighting, why they're still arguing, why they're still experiencing hell on earth.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Just before we totally leave your background in the media, I hope you'll indulge us, because I'm sure my listeners are, you know, I've already been over to Twitter and told everybody that you had written and produced quite a few UFO documentaries. And is it true that you founded something called New Earth Communications?
Yes.
Are you still producing programming through that?
Not actively. It's definitely, I've worked on and off with that company for many, many years. It's my own company. And most of my life, I made my living writing, directing, and producing. So it's what I've done for 90% of my life. That's what I've done, and I love it. And I'm sure, how it is. There's cycles in life. There's things we explore. For 20 years, I've been involved in secret sexuality and tantra. I've gone through more than one phase of my life where I was actively involved in metaphysical studies and UFOs. I've been involved and interested in communication my entire life. We kind of go through themes, and themes come in and out of our life. And I'm one of those guys that I don't get angry, disillusioned, and say never again. Quite the contrary. Everything I've done, I've enjoyed. I'm grateful for it. I think every spiritual path has value. And I always just like kind of following the natural flow of my own personal evolution and then paying attention to what's really alive for me. Right now it's very alive sharing these tools of compassionate communication. But if the right project came along that I really wanted to sink my teeth into, I will.
Okay. By the way, I am so thrilled, and I want to send out a big thank you to our station manager, Donald Newsom. He was on, because I didn't know if you were sure for today's show until 2 hours before airtime, and we have you on the front page of our website. So.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah. When I'm online, I'll go check it out.
Yeah, bbsradio.com. Your smiling face is right there on page one. So, very excited about that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say one last thing about kind of the producing thing. Is where the two have met for me throughout my life, Veronica. When I was a teenager, I started a theater company with the idea of plays for teenagers, by teenagers, about teenagers. And that company happened to become very successful at a very early age. By the time I was 21, I had 85 employees, and I won my first Emmy Award at 23 and my second Emmy Award at 25.
Wow.
But if you take a look at that, and actually even way back then, what was I doing? I was involved in media, and I was producing shows designed to raise consciousness. And really, those are the themes professionally of my life. How can I reach people with messages, information that's of value, and to do it in a way that's fun, and to do it in a way that's effective. And whether I'm trying to share with people what might have really happened at Area 51 or in Roswell, or whether I'm sharing how to get along better with your wife or how to really understand your teenager, it's really all kind of variations on the same theme of how to present it in a way that people will hear it, enjoy it, and apply it to their life in a way that creates greater value.
Scott, I totally relate to what you're saying. I was just talking to a friend earlier today who said that everything that I am working on has something to do with sex. And I didn't bother to correct her because I was thinking, well, I have a broad definition of sex. She might be right. But, when I give it more thought, it's not actually true. I think that it's not the sex part of it, it's the shame part of it that I'm focused on bringing things that people keep buried, that they're afraid of, up into the light so that they can be, felt, experienced, and hopefully healed. And it just so happens that sex is a big part of that because, most Western culture is very, very sex-phobic. But I have the same passion for working with, the fact that, well, this whole thing about domestic violence, you know, I have, a broader definition of that than most people, too, because I think slamming doors is a form of perpetration. So, but you have to be careful because a lot of people, you know, if you say sex, they think genitals. If you say domestic violence, they think bruises. And, the conversation that I'm trying to engage the world in is let's stop having secrets. Let's start talking about the truth so that we can be whole.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right on. Thank you, first of all. I really respect you for your perspective. And I really respect you for putting it out there. And I'm sure that you've taken your share of arrows in the back.
part of the territory.
It's part of being a pioneer. And I respect you for that. One of the things that I often use as an analogy, in compassionate communication, one of the foundations of our understanding, and this is very much a Marshall Rosenberg perspective, is that everything we do, every action every human being takes, is to fulfill some universal need, a longing, a desire, a basic value, our physical well-being, our emotional well-being, and that be to meet our need for respect, our need for understanding, our need for love, our need for food. These are what drive us.
Yeah.
And sometimes we do things that are clumsy in our efforts to meet our needs. And that's usually when I'm working with couples or families. They've done things that are clumsy. But sometimes people do things that are tragic in order to meet their needs.
Hmm.
And Marshall has a very beautiful line, and I'm going to deliver the line and then give an example, which I think you'll appreciate. The line is, the quote, is that even the most horrible crimes are tragic attempts to get precious needs met.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what I always think of when I hear that is the horrible, horrible crime of a Catholic or Christian or any priest that becomes pedophile, that behaves in the behavior of a pedophile.
Right.
Horrible, horrible, horrible crime. But if you go deeper into it, not to condone the crime, but what was happening, it was a tragic attempt to get a precious need met. And I would imagine in most of those cases, you have a person who feels such shame over their sexual desires, and they're in a culture where they're not supposed to honor or acknowledge their sexual desires, so they stuff the shame, they stuff the shame, they stuff the shame, until they act out in a completely horrible, horrific, inappropriate manner.
See, you and I are on the same page there, because I some people will postulate that the priesthood attracts pedophiles, and I don't agree. I think it manufactures them.
Absolutely. I could not agree more, because we have a basic universal need for intimacy and for sexual expression. They're basic values, they're basic needs. And you can even see it in children. Even children who aren't necessarily sexual beings, but they're some of the sensual beings,
Actually, something? Children are sexual from before birth. We now have it on. We got it. We got the videotape. They are masturbating in the womb.
Are they really?
To the point of orgasm. To the point of orgasm. Yes.
Wow, you're educating me. I didn't know this.
I actually find this rather funny when I think about some of the religious conservative people who are sitting in church listening to their minister or their priest or their rabbi or whoever talk about the evils of masturbation, and they're all pregnant because they don't believe in birth control, and yet their babies are masturbating right there during services.
Wow.
I think it's kind of funny.
Thank you for sharing that. I did not know that. That's a really
hey, if you want to see it, God, I'll think of her name in a minute. But it's on TED, T-E-D. TED,
I've actually been to a TED conference in my life.
Look up for 10 things you didn't know about orgasms.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's
and it's beautiful. She actually has the videotape of the male baby masturbating, and you can see it right during her lecture. It was awesome.
Wow. For any of your listeners who don't know, if you ever want to know what the cutting edge thinkers and technology is, go to TED.com. Once a year, there's a conference which takes place in the Silicon Valley.
You've presented there, haven't you?
I would love to present at TED. I filmed TED. I haven't presented there yet, but I sure would enjoy that. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I joined the website a few months ago. I'm just it's amazing because they're putting out new thought, and
exactly.
Yeah, so that it's not the stuff that's entrenched in the system. It's brand new thought, which and one of my fans, Sue Savage Rimba, I think is how you say her name. She's the bonobo lady. She does research on bonobos. She also spoke at TED.
Bonobos are amazing. And, of course, if we all could just be like bonobos, how much happier we would be.
I was lecturing about that last night. Hey, I want to check in with the callers here because we're about half past, not quite. And for those of you who are listening in, I am communicating via Twitter and also a toll-free number. So you can either Twitter me over here at Twitter / Veronica Monet. Or you can give us a phone call at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. That's toll free to you. And if you have a question or a comment, maybe you've seen some of Scott's films or television programs, or maybe you are having some relationship drama that you'd like a little advice on, I'm sure Scott would be thrilled to help you. So can you tell us a little bit more about the workshops that you teach?
Yeah, you know what I'll do is I'll give you the Reader's Digest condensed version, really, of what it's all about for me. There's two pieces. One is that we always want to choose connection first when we're having a disagreement with someone, especially someone that we care about, I want to have a healthy long-term relationship with. Now, inevitably, what happens most of the time, you know, the old paradigm way of thinking, the old paradigm way of being, is that if we're in a disagreement with someone, we're arguing to be right, or we're arguing to be understood, or we're trying to get them to do something, or we're avoiding doing what it is they want us to do, and we're in a power struggle. In this way of thinking, once we realize, okay, whoops, we've gotten into a red zone, we either take a break, because if I can't drop into my heart, I really don't want to connect with you. I can't connect with you. So if I can't drop into my heart, then I need to take a break. I need to take a time out. And during that time out, I'm going to give myself empathy and understanding and all the things I'm trying to get from you, I'm going to handle on my own or with help of a friend. So that when I do come back to my connection with you, I do come back to my conversation with you, I'm in my heart. And I can really then listen to your point of view. I can listen to your perspective. I can understand what's going on with you. And here's something very important for people to remember. Understanding someone does not mean that we agree. It doesn't even mean that we condone. It just means that we understand, oh, this is what you're feeling, this is what you're needing. And when we at least understand or acknowledge what another person is feeling or needing or thinking, then that drops us into connection. And once we're in connection, then wonderful things can happen. The other major piece that I teach, and everything that I do in the workshops, are tools to actually achieve what I'm describing. And that is, it's like a mathematical equation, Veronica. Just like, I'm sure on some level, you know, there's certain aspects to sexuality, certain things that are chemical. There's, you know, body chemistry. Well, literally, there's almost like a mathematical equation to how happy we are in our relationships. To the degree that a relationship has blame, shame, criticism, or judgment, is the degree that that relationship is hell. Relationships that are pure hell are pure criticism, judgment, blame, and shame. On the other hand, we can create heaven on earth in our relationships. We can take the same situation and pivot and actually experience heaven with our partners, even if it's a partner that we've been fighting with. The key is we've got to drop blame, shame, judgment, and criticism and replace it with acceptance, acknowledgement, appreciation, reassurance, and being in an open heart, having an open mind. Now, obviously, it sounds easier than it is. You know, the workshops are kind of practicing how to do this. When I do private sessions, I'm helping, you know, couples learn how to do this. But the fact is we can communicate and be understood so much more effectively when we are in a state of acceptance and appreciation and reassurance than when we're in blame, shame, judgment, and criticism. It's just that we're used to doing the old paradigm way, the kind of right, wrong, good, bad way. And there's one last piece.
Right. Scott, doesn't it seem to you that the culture has actually become a little more abusive in its communication style? Like, most of the reality TV shows seem to be about blame and shame. That's my perception.
I think that's true. But honestly, even most of the situation comedies for the last 20 years, even the really, really funny ones, the way people talk to each other is slicing and dicing. You know, they're slicing and dicing each other, and we just think it's hilarious. You know, whether it's Roseanne or
right.
The Simpsons, and I'm a big Simpsons fan. I'm a big Family Guy fan. I think they're hilarious shows.
Yes, but they are slicing and dicing. For sure.
But they're slicing and dicing each other, literally.
Well, I'm sort of relieved to hear that you know what? I have a guilty pleasure. It's these court TV shows. Because I love it when the judge yells at people and tells them how stupid they are.
I
always think to myself, is this because I do not allow myself to express myself in this way? I have to watch these TV shows.
You know, I think that it's balance in all things. And I love life, and I love to laugh. And, gosh, you saw me on the website holding the picture with the jackal and the giraffe. Well, those are the puppets that represent the two sides of us. The jackal is that part of us that blames and shames and judges, criticizes. And the giraffe is that part of us that drops into our heart, has a long neck, sees the big picture, has a big heart, and is very strong. Well, one of the things I always emphasize is I love my inner jackal. I love my inner jackal, and I appreciate my inner jackal, and my inner jackal serves me. Because if I am dealing with somebody, you know, I meet somebody new, and I get a funky vibe, and there's some part of me that goes, I want to get away from this person, that's something to pay attention to. And I can set my boundary without judging them. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to make that person wrong, but it's a way of letting me know, there's something uncomfortable here. There's a vibe. There's something that I'm not liking. Or it might be something very blatant. Somebody might say something to me and I find it offensive. And my inner jackal might go, Jesus, what a jerk. But then I recognize that, okay, my first impression is he's a jerk. What's really going on? What am I feeling? What am I meaning? Oh, my need to respect isn't being met by the way he's talking about my wife, or the way he's talking about my friend Veronica. So I have a need for respect that's not being met. I have a need for understanding, because he's going on about how this chick Veronica Monet doesn't understand what shame really is. So, you know, I'm noticing that he's not matching my values, he's not matching my beliefs, he's not matching my way of understanding. So now I have a choice. I can take space, or I can see if there's a way that I can connect with him while understanding, acknowledging my understanding of what it is he's saying, and then if I acknowledge my understanding of what he's saying without making him wrong, will there then be an opening for me to present my perspective or how I see Veronica?
Yeah. Do you know who Kelly Bryson is?
Kelly's a friend of mine. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Kelly's a friend.
He's a friend of mine, too. I for the listeners, Kelly Bryson, author, he comes out of Marshall Rosenberg's camp as well, and has a book called Don't Be Nice, Be Real, a book I highly recommend. I found it life-changing. And one time I was asking Kelly, I said, well, what do you do when, you know, you get angry? Because I said, man, the judgmental voice is in my head. And he said, I just run with it. I go ahead. You know, if I want to say bad words in my head, whatever it takes to go ahead and indulge in that emotion so that I can move through it as opposed to, like, it getting stuck in my throat, you know?
Right.
So I found that really liberating, too, because, of course, and after I read his book, I thought, well, he's probably perfect. He probably never even has a disparaging thought about other people.
I'm
sorry?
I think that the Dalai Lama has jackal thoughts all the time, but he's learned how to manage them. He's learned how to notice the jackal thought, notice the judgment, acknowledge it, and then do whatever process in his mind drops into his heart and reflects back a more heartful, compassionate understanding of the same situation.
I know for me, by giving myself permission to go ahead and be human in that respect instead of trying to, it's like trying to forgive somebody. That doesn't work. You have to actually go through the process of being angry and then getting to the point where you've started to heal and you can not try to forgive, but actually forgive. And I notice that if I allow myself to go ahead and have those jackal-like feelings, I'm more likely to quickly, you know, come around. And because what I know, the more severely I'm taking somebody's inventory, the less I'm feeling good about myself that day. Because I can tell, on the days I feel great about me and everything in my life is going well, I just don't have time to care about judging another person. It's not a priority. There's no time, no energy, no juice for it. It's boring. But on the days when I'm frustrated and I'm feeling inadequate and I'm thinking, why can't I get this? Then it becomes a real big pleasure. You know?
Yeah. That's right on. One of the process for forgiveness that I share with people, it's very similar to what you're saying, is let's say I've done something that's triggered you, and I took an action or said something that caused you pain, that caused you discomfort. Now, on the one hand, whatever you're feeling are your feelings. I can never make someone feel angry. I can never make someone happy. Your feelings are your feelings, just like your needs are your needs. But I can be present to your feelings. And so the way I look at it is if I had done something that caused you discomfort, the forgiveness process is for me to just sit down and fully be present, fully listen to your experience without defending myself and without saying I'm sorry. Because I'm sorry can be a band-aid. I'm sorry can be, okay, I'm sorry, now can we go on? Now can we be friends again? No. Just totally listen, and as best as I can, in my heart, not in my head which wants to defend, not in my head which wants to evaluate you, but in my heart, just feel, oh, this is what Monica felt. This is what she experienced. Really feel it, and if I can properly, truly feel it, then that will evoke within me a desire to never do that again because I feel your pain and I don't want to create pain or lend to pain. And if you get that I get you, and if you get that I really am experiencing to some degree your pain, and that stimulates in within me an authentic response of I don't want to ever take that action again because I never want to repeat this, then you're more likely to really be able to give authentic forgiveness.
Yeah. No, I come out of the 12-step background, so that whole I'm sorry thing doesn't cut it. Because,
right.
You know, we practice these 12 steps, and step 9 is make amends wherever possible. And step 9 is not about I'm sorry. a man's, so we have a real distinction between apologizing and making an amends. And if somebody offers me an apology, I usually kind of go, you know, I'm not really into those. I'd love to hear about your personal journey. Like, is there something that you've learned that you're going to do different because you've seen that it's to your own benefit? Or maybe if you actually did cost me something and you plan on somehow or another, you know, restoring me, that'd be nice to hear about. But as far as the words I'm sorry, my experience is that that usually becomes not just a Band-Aid, but permission to do it again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Can I do it again? Because I didn't actually learn anything. I'm not going to be able to alter that behavior, but I sure am embarrassed.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. So what's your ultimate objective here? I you seem like somebody who's had a fairly thought-out professional life. And maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was all organic and spontaneous, and it just happened to net you 3 Emmys and a bunch of television programs and a film. I don't know. But I'm just wondering if you have a trajectory for yourself right now.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I was born on Christmas Day, and when I was a little boy growing up in Granada Hills, California, I literally believed that it was up to me to save the world. I had a Messiah complex. I didn't think that I was the Messiah because I didn't even understand what a Messiah was. But I had this just huge burning thing that I've got to save the world. I've got to save the world. I need to make the world a better place. Now, fortunately, as I grew older, first I went through the phase of freaking out. And by the time I was 10 years old, I had an ulcer, or the beginnings of an ulcer. Because
wow.
I was just old enough to understand how big the planet was. And I was just a little boy. And, you know, so it was really overwhelming, and I was really freaking out. And so first I thought I would change the world through politics. So I studied everything about politics. But that became pretty discouraging because, you know, by the time I was 12, I realized, well, you can't be president until you're 35. And I probably understood pretty early on that even the president doesn't really have as much power as one would think, and it just didn't seem like the right way. So then I thought, okay, I'll do it through religion. So I studied religion well. By the time I was 14, I was completely turned off because I had read enough and learned enough to see that religion had caused some of the most horrible crimes and some of the most horrible conditions on the planet were caused by, you know, people who are religious fanatics.
Right.
So then I got turned on to the media. Oh, that's how I can make a difference through the media. And actually, Walt Disney, I read a biography about Walt Disney, and I realized that I had grown up, with Disney values, that a lot of my ideas and belief systems of right and wrong and my values were actually shaped by the Disney movies that I had watched. And that Walt Disney actually had this huge influence. So then I decided to do it through the media. And that, by that time I was 16, so I started the theater company, plays for teenagers, by teenagers, about teenagers. And I did that for 15 years. And then we expanded beyond doing plays. We started doing television shows. And something that's kind of relevant, actually, to today's news is for 11 years, so that I could stay connection with teenagers even once I was in my 20s, I produced and co-ran a camp in Santa Barbara at Jane Fonda's Ranch. Every summer, we would do 5 camp sessions, 50 kids per session. And we were not far from Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch. And Jane met Michael and invited him to the ranch, and he saw what we were doing. And he donated enough money for us to build a theater, which we actually dedicated the Michael Jackson Children's Theater. And so he came up on several occasions to the ranch and kind of checked out what we were doing. And, you know, he really loved children and loved what we were all about. And so I actually met him on several occasions. So, of course, you know, given what recently happened, you know, I've been thinking about my memories of when I met Michael Jackson and my experience of him. And I'm imagining this might be of interest to you and your viewers, your listeners.
Well, certainly. He just died, so.
you know, in terms of the whole shame thing and what we were talking about, I mean, of course, I have no idea what really happened. But I want to say that the man I met, and this was back in the 1980s, so it was like 20, 22, 23 years ago. Mm-hmm. But first off, we all would have bet that he was a virgin. He came across as completely asexual.
Yeah.
He was tender, sensitive, extraordinarily gentle. He had deer in the headlights kind of look on him, and just an extremely gentle, sweet being. And what I'm telling myself, what I'm imagining, and what we all, you know, and of course we all talked about it, you know, what do you think, what's his sexuality, what's his trip? And then, you know, when all the, you know, stories started coming out, I imagined that he loved children so much and so wanted to be and honor the child within him that he enjoyed close connection and intimacy with children, even to the point of cuddling and maybe even sleeping with them. But I don't believe that he was sexual with children. I don't believe that he crossed that line. Of course, I'll never know, but just based on who I met and how I experienced him, I just, in honor of Michael Jackson, may he be happy where he is now, that was my experience of him.
Yeah. Well, what was your take on the death? Do you think that was...
It would appear that I'm telling myself that this man took so many pharmaceutical drugs that his heart just gave out, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I read that he had been sued for a $108,000 pharmaceutical bill, I mean, even if you're paying 10 times what you should be paying, $108,000 for the pharmaceuticals?
That's a lot.
Jesus. What's this man putting in his body?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm telling myself that I don't think it was, you know, maybe a Heath Ledger type of a situation. I don't think he committed suicide. He was clearly very excited about doing these shows in London. And I think that he just was so used to whatever he was trying to make his body feel, trying to make it happen pharmaceutically. And I think his heart or something within him just said, I can't do this anymore, and gave out.
That's really a sad thing. A lot of people who have all this access to good health care, but the doctors that are working with them just can't seem to prescribe enough pills. They just keep throwing chemicals at them. It's a really sad thing. I mean, the human body wasn't created to absorb all of that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so you got to meet Jane Fonda, too, then, I guess.
Well, Jane and I became very close. We actually produced a television project together called Jane Fonda's Unsung Heroes. It was a project we did for Showtime. Unfortunately, we only got a chance to do two pilot episodes, and then there was a change of management at Showtime, and then threw out all the old projects. And then shortly after that, Jane's life took a big change, and she went from being married to Tom Hayden. When I was doing the camp, it was at a ranch that Tom and Jane owned together, and it was very much a Tom and Jane project. And then when they separated, and she became Mrs. Ted Turner, she sold the ranch, the camp got shut down, she moved to Atlanta, and she did the Ted Turner phase. But I periodically see her. I saw her in Mill Valley last year, and big hug, and hi, how are you? She came over, we talked for a little bit. So there's still a connection. But, you know, she's an amazing woman. Absolutely amazing woman. And you talk about somebody who's got an arrows in the back.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about a pioneer woman, you know.
Oh, yeah. People are still throwing arrows in her back. And speaking of pioneers.
Something that happened so long ago.
You also, I'm looking at your website right now here. In 2007, you were trained by Al Gore to present his Climate Project slide and video show. There's a picture of you with Al Gore.
Sure. Well, you know, when An Inconvenient Truth came out, of course, it was a big success. And Al's been showing this slideshow to anybody who wanted to watch it for 20 years. You know, the slideshow keeps evolving, you know, but, you know, he entered politics for the purpose of trying to raise consciousness about the environment. That's why he entered the political field. And so, he, when he had all the success and everybody, now everybody and their brother wants the slideshow, and he can't run around the world doing it. So he came up with a very smart idea. He came up with the idea of training 1,000 people worldwide to learn how to give this presentation.
Wow.
And fortunately, I have a good friend who's very politically connected, and so she heard about this, and she decided to apply for his program. And she knows that I'm a bit of a ham and a public speaker and that I've been an environmental activist most of my life. She said, Scott, you know, you ought to apply also, especially because of all your work working with teenagers and winning Emmy Awards and, you know, you're always giving public speaking about something. So I applied, and to my, you know, great joy, I got accepted into the program. So in January of 2007, I was trained by Al Gore and some of his scientists. And actually just recently, just last month, we had a reunion in Tennessee, in Nashville. And there was a reunion of Climate Project presenters from all over the world. And I actually got a chance to, both times, both when I first trained with Al and again last month, I had a chance to connect with him. I have new photos with Al, which I'll have to send you.
Oh, please
do. The highlight of my time last month with him was I got a chance to share with Al and 500 others how to use compassionate communication when dealing with people who still deny climate change. And Al really likes my approach. I'm telling myself, I'll never know, because I wasn't in his head, but as he was listening to me talk about it, and as I was watching his facial reactions and then how he responded, it appeared to me like this really was a unique way of dealing with it. It seemed as though he hadn't used that approach before, and he clearly liked it. You know, he commended it. So that, you know, my ego loved that, so, you know, I don't
really
know the ego part of it, you know. Like, woohoo, yay, I showed something to Professor Al. But also, it was nice to kind of bring together those two worlds. And I do use compassionate communication when I'm giving Climate Project presentations to people.
Well, you know, and speaking of vice presidents and presidents and all that, I wanted to get your professional opinion about our President Barack Obama. I volunteered some for his campaign, and I've certainly voted for him. He's the first president in my lifetime that I've ever called my president. So,
cool.
Yeah. However, I have found myself starting to feel concerned about him because I saw some outtakes from a recent press conference, and it seemed like he was kind of sniping at the press and being defensive. And, you know, and as we all know, having watched him go through the presidential debates, this man was, I thought, an amazing role model for how not to get drug into, you know, the kind of shenanigans that Palin and John McCain and the rest of them were doing, and, you know, because he usually stuck with the issues. He didn't retaliate. And he stayed consistent with his message by, you know, saying the same thing over and over again, no matter what the opposition says. But I'm wondering now if the stresses of his presidency are starting to kind of take their toll on him or, you know, or what. And for, I guess the first question is a two-part question. Have you seen any of the recent television footage that seem to indicate that he might be kind of losing his previous calm demeanor? And then secondly, do you have any advice for people on, you know, let's say you have these skill sets, you're doing pretty good, and then you do start to get stressed out, and you find yourself, you know, reverting back to old behavior. Do you have any tips for how you can get back on track?
So, well,
two-part question.
Sure. Well, first off, you know, of course, I cannot even begin to imagine the pressure that this guy's under. And I certainly, you know, certainly having been involved in the whole UFO thing, you know, obviously the government makes a lot of choices that are not necessarily based on what are in the best interests of the common people. I think we all pretty well can imagine that a lot of the decisions that have been made by our government are decisions that are made to please the oil companies, to please the military-industrial complex. And so between the lobbyists for large corporations like the pharmaceuticals, the military-industrial complex, the oil industry, there is such enormous pressure and control of the political system. And honestly, I have no idea how far that goes. In my imagining, it's possible. I have no idea what the truth is, but it's possible it goes as far as the United States, some covert part of the United States government, supporting, aiding, abetting, or even creating 911. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility, but I certainly don't know what the true story is.
Yeah, me neither, but I have seen the tapes.
I've seen the tapes, and you know, something funky happened. There's definitely, we haven't been told the whole story.
Well, with the Pentagon, sure something certainly did. With the Pentagon, the, you know, there's a movie camera missing.
Right, right. Oh, there's so many pieces. I mean, that's a whole show unto itself. And
yeah.
So given that our government is not made up of wonderful, nice people who are looking out for what's best for Veronica and Scott and everybody else, our government is made up of politicians who, in order to keep their jobs or in order to get their needs met, have to make enormous compromises in support of large, large corporations. So what I'm imagining is Obama had no idea how difficult it would be to affect change. And he actually said that in his State of the Union speech. He said, when somebody asked him what his biggest disappointment was, he was very clear. He said, I didn't realize it would be so difficult to get things done. I didn't realize it would be so hard to make change. So that's the one piece that, in terms of your question, I'm clear on. He's surprised and disappointed that it's as difficult as it is.
Maybe that explains, last week he said something, he was sniping at a reporter and said, but I'm the president. And I could, he probably like thought being president was going to be more powerful maybe than it is.
Yeah. So the other piece that kind of relates to all of this, which I do appreciate about Obama, is this. In my teaching, in the compassion communication teaching that I share, and I want to acknowledge, by the way, that I often teach with my wife, whom I'm very much in love with, and who is...
I'm looking at a picture of her right now. Her name's Gabrielle, and she's beautiful.
Thank you. And you met her, actually. You met Gabrielle.
Oh.
I met you up at Harbin.
At Harbin?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
when I get those presentations, a lot of times I just, I get so focused on the material and the people who come up afterwards to get books autographed, I forget.
I understand. Well, anyway, she and I teach often together, and also my good friend Gary Callison, who teaches and covers my classes at Harvard when I'm not there. Just want to acknowledge them because they've been they're my best friends, and they also help me to really practice this and keep learning it. So anyway, acknowledging them, and I want to share the Obama perspective of what I think Obama does represent that's wonderful.
Okay, and I gotta warn you, we got about 5 minutes, so.
Great, I can do this in 60 seconds.
Okay.
The old paradigm, the old way of thinking, listening, and expressing was right, wrong, good, bad. And the Bush-Cheney administration did a wonderful job of showing the world what happens when you have you're either good or you're bad. You're either with us or you're against us. When you have that mentality, and you make decisions from that mentality, and if anybody disagrees with you, you get rid of them, and you only surround yourself with people who agree with you and will support you and do everything you want to do, we have seen what kind of results you get from that way of thinking.
Right.
And I think most of us would agree the results sucked and have been enormously expensive in taking a toll of human life, not to mention devastating many economies, including our own.
Yeah.
What I do appreciate about Obama is that he represents what I believe is the new paradigm, which is boundaries with compassion. We need to set boundaries. It's very important to set boundaries, but we can do it in a compassionate way. So it's not that because somebody has a different opinion than me that they're wrong or bad, but maybe I'm going to set a boundary and still listen. Where are you coming from? What is it that you're needing? And that's what I like about Obama. I like that he surrounded himself, that he immediately made his competitor, Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of State. And that he put Republicans and different people with different thoughts into his cabinet and made it very clear. He said, many times I want to surround myself with people who have different perspectives, different opinions, and I want to listen to as many different opinions as I can before I make big decisions. Now, that is beautiful.
Yeah. And he's also modeled exactly what he said he was going to do, which was converse with countries that the old guard did not even want to talk to.
Exactly. Yeah. So, are there things that he's done that I'm disappointed in? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm disappointed that there hasn't been a quicker drawdown out of the Middle East. But I have no idea what kind of pressure that man's under. I really don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know either. There's several things I've been disappointed in. I wanted to see him take a stronger stance on behalf of gays, and I wanted to see him take a stronger stance on Abu Ghraib. And it seemed like this whole thing about, you know, not showing the pictures. I personally am very much against being paternal towards American citizens, like, oh, well, they can't handle that, so we can't give them the information. To me, we're right back to Area 51. It's like,
right.
The American public is too feeble-minded. We can't give them this information. So
let me compassionately, I'll turn to this in 1 minute, give a little compassion to how that all started. Because I did have the opportunity to meet, I told you about this privately when we were talking this earlier today, that I did have the opportunity to meet a man named Frank Kaufman and interview him, who was very involved in the Roswell crash in 1947. He was right there. He was the head of the Civilian Intelligence Corps. He was one of the actual decision makers. And what Frank pointed out was back then we had no protocol. And when that UFO crashed and we realized what we had, and the whole world was freaked out because of the atomic bomb, we were the only ones with an atomic bomb. The Russians were desperately trying to get one. And we didn't know what would happen when lots of people got atomic weapons or got advanced weaponry. And it's something of a miracle that there has only been two atomic bomb, you know, attacks, or, you know, dropping the bombs, and the United States did it both times. It's amazing that nothing's happened since 1945. I mean, it's amazing. It's like a miracle. And we have to realize that when that UFO crashed, nobody knew how to handle it. There was no precedent for it. It was a whole new thing. And there was such, within the people in the military, there was such a, we cannot let the Russians know about this. We have got to guard this. And there really was a genuine, I really do understand, given the times, we're just out of World War II. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if there's going to be, you know, we're just coming out of huge devastation. I can understand why the decision was made to cover it up, quiet things down, and there are a lot of people that I've interviewed who I believe who said the reason we won the computer race, the reason we won the technology race, is because we had our hands on that UFO and we were able to reverse engineer it, and it gave us a lot of secrets that led to Silicon Valley and the computer industry kicking off out of the United States initially. Until other countries could take what we came up with and do their own better job of it. But,
right.
You know,
right.
We, you know, the fact that we had, that we got somebody on the moon first, that we had all these things happen, there are people that I've interviewed that are, who are very intelligent, very well respected, former astronauts, military officials, scientists, and they all said the same thing. Oh, yeah. Because we got that technology first. It gave us an enormous heads up that has led to the United States being the only remaining superpower in the world, for better or for worse.
Scott, we're going to have to end there, but will you come back and maybe tell my listeners a little bit about what you found out about Area 51 and also some of the UFOs that you ended up filming yourself? Can we have you back to talk about that?
Yeah, in fact, maybe what we can do is in advance I'll send you some clips and maybe you can put some video clips, little teasers and some legitimate photos and footage.
Oh, you got it. You got it. I would love to do that. I love you. I love what you do, and I have so much respect for you. Thank you so much for being you and for helping to make the world a better place to live in.
My pleasure. God's blessings to you, and I'll look forward to our next connection.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?